Hey, buddy.
No, you can't start off like that. You got to start off yelling. You got to start off being like real angry at me, like absolutely just fury. You wasted an hour and 45 minutes of my time, you rapscallion. And definitely use the word rapscallion. Everybody likes hearing that on the radio. Welcome to the Save vs. Poison podcast, the podcast dedicated to gaming, general geekery, and enduring sobriety in an ever-maddening society, with your host Will and two guys that probably live under his stairs. If you're an addict, know an addict, or are just interested in exploring the outer mysteries of geekery, you're in the right place. Without further ado, let's get to the show. Welcome back to the show, everybody. Yes, it is season 3, episode 24, and today's show, I'm really, really excited. It's our season finale. Tiki and Steve have the night off, so instead, joining me from his beautiful home in Boulder, Colorado, he's a triple threat. He's a doctor. He's Harvard trained. At one time was a vegetarian that didn't tell me about it. He's my friend, Dr. Michael Gallagher. Hey, Mike.
Hello, Will.
How are you, buddy?
Doing great. How about you?
I'm good, man. I'm good. First question. What's your favorite part of doing this interview twice?
We had a little snafu. This is our second go-round, and I would say I have yet to learn what my favorite part will be, but I feel well-rehearsed.
Yeah, no doubt.
We did a dress rehearsal.
And you look good in your dress. You were stunning in your dress for the dress rehearsal. Thank you so much for that.
We only ever see each other wearing blue scrubs.
And for anybody that doesn't know what scrubs are, I know everybody does, but they're the best, most respected set of clothing that closes with a drawstring. And that's how I've always thought about it. I've always wanted to be in pajamas from the time that I got up to the time that I did something professional to the time that I went to bed. And that's what we've done. We've found that niche.
Occasionally we see each other in underwear getting into the scrubs.
That's
but
true.
That's about it.
That's true. Although not everybody in that locker room does that. Why do you just wear nothing under your scrubs? I don't get that. I don't understand why those people do that. Anyways, the locker room's a fantastic, fascinating place. Speaking of things that we do over and over and over again, my name's Will, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Will. My name is Michael, and I have myalgic encephalomyelitis.
It's too many syllables.
It is a lot of syllables and hard to put them all together.
It is. So Mike joins me tonight because just recently he put out a book. Just recently is April 22nd, I think, was the release date. Is that correct?
April 26th.
All right, so yes, we're off, sir. Just a little tiny bit. So April 26th, you put out a book that was titled Run Down, an Endurance Athlete's Race Against Chronic Fatigue.
Yes, sir. It is a memoir. I wrote it over the course of, let me think about this, 2021. And it was a journey of self-exploration, and I didn't realize I was capable of writing a book, and I did, and super excited that it's finished and in its polished form and out into the world.
So the subject matter of the book, you said that it's a memoir. What makes your story something that you wanted to put into that format?
I think everybody sort of has this idea that maybe they'll write a book one day. It actually materialized for me because I went through an illness that I previously misunderstood and that a lot of people out there misunderstood. And I went through a journey that is common for people with the illness, that is a frustrating process and sometimes a scary process. And so the book, in addition to laughing, crying, entertaining, you know, that sort of thing, is meant to shine a light on something that is misunderstood both in the medical community and by the rest of the world.
Certainly. What's the name of the condition?
Myalgic encephalomyelitis.
Myalgic encephalomyelitis. I practiced in the mirror that one.
That alone is reason for it to be misunderstood. Used to be called chronic fatigue syndrome, still is in my subtitle and in a colloquial term, but myalgic encephalomyelitis is the most newest in fashion version of the disease name for chronic fatigue syndrome.
So what is chronic fatigue syndrome?
It's a condition that has several different symptoms. Most strikingly is not necessarily fatigue. That's sort of a misnomer. While fatigue is a really common component, the most striking components are things like post-exertional malaise, meaning if someone with ME/CFS exerts themselves, and that could be going for a run, it could also be walking up the stairs, brushing your teeth, they feel very sick afterwards. Not necessarily tired, but sick like you have the flu or a hangover or a GI bug, something like that. That is one of the most striking and omnipresent symptoms, but there are other things like brain fog or pain or unrefreshing sleep. So it's actually a constellation of symptoms more than it is one specific disease.
Because it's a constellation of symptoms and less if you have influenza, you might have one of many different influenzas, but
right,
you have influenza. How well understood is the disease process?
It is still nebulous. There is more understanding now than there has been in the past. We think it is a neurological disorder, neuroimmune, so the immune system perhaps attacking the brain and spinal cord. But we also think it might have to do with the inner parts of the cell called the mitochondria that produce your energy. So, you know, if I was a Tesla, my battery would be really old and not very well able to be charged versus somebody with a perfectly normal battery that accepts a charge every time they sleep and eat and all that stuff. My battery will not accept a full charge and it runs out pretty quickly.
Right, right. Now, in addition to being a physician, and I didn't know that you were a Harvard-trained physician until I read the book, which has to be an absolute testament to your character, because I feel like your opening line should be, "Hi there, Dr. Michael Gallagher, Harvard trained," and the checkout girl goes, "Paper or plastic, bro?" And then you move throughout your day after that while they look at you like you're the a-hole. I didn't know. I've known you since 2009. You were the very first surgeon that I ever worked with at Kaiser Permanente. We had a great day. We did some hardware removal stuff. We did some fracture clinic stuff. We had a great day. And I knew that you were a vegetarian before I knew that you were Harvard trained. And that was only because it came up organically. Another thing that you didn't brag about.
It's hard to bring it up in conversation without sounding like a complete douche.
Yeah, seriously.
But the vegetarian thing comes up all the time because someone says, "Do you want a bite of my meatball sub?"
A lot of people offer you meatball sub.
Yeah, on the daily, Will.
On the daily. I don't know. I think I asked if you wanted to go out for wings or something. "Hey, man, want to join me for wings?" And I was like, "Yeah, I'd love to, but you know, I'm a vegetarian, so I'd kind of be lost on me or
these
something."
These days, like, I would join you.
These days, you would. Well, unfortunately, yeah. Now I'm not eating wings anymore. much to my waistline's happiness and my spirit's chagrin.
Yes.
God, so much protein, none of it delicious.
No cheat days on the wings?
Not yet. We're still 14 pounds away from the 100-pound mark. So we've got a little ways to go before I feel like I can treat myself again.
That is incredible.
Thanks, man. Thanks. It's been a journey, and we could talk about that some other time. But we are, unfortunately, because you are a busy man, a little pressed for time. So you're an endurance athlete. The first chapter of the book, the introduction to the book, is literally you talking about being at the Boston Marathon, the year that the Boston Marathon bomb went off. And then, so that was what, 2013, I think?
2013.
Yeah, yep. 2013. So you're at the Boston Marathon, which is not something that is easily qualified for. You cross the finish line well before, you know, everything terrible happens there. But you draw a comparison between the bomb of this disease going off in your life and the marathon, which I thought was, you know, pretty poetically done. I thought it was really, really well done. So you are an endurance athlete. You are a surgeon. You are a high-functioning human being. How long did you struggle before you found a diagnosis?
Great question. A lot of people struggle for a long time. That was true in my case. So in 2013, as you mentioned, I ran Boston. That same year, I did an Ironman. Then I went back to Boston the following year. And that was April 2014. Just 6 weeks later, I got a virus. My kids had hand, foot, and mouth disease, which a lot of kids get. My wife got it. A neighbor got it. It's not that common for adults. And I got it. And I stupidly or fatefully went on a mountain bike trip while I was sick. I did not get a diagnosis until 2020, so 6 years later.
Jeez.
Yeah. I knew something was wrong immediately when I got back from the bike trip. And it waxed and waned. And there was a year and a half where the symptoms pretty much went away. But they kept coming back and kept coming back. And nobody really knew what to make of it. And it's a hard illness to diagnose until the symptoms are severe. And then it's not too late, per se, but the damage is done. The die is cast in a lot of ways.
So as far as like concrete tests or treatments, because it's so nebulous, we're looking at, you know, chucking things into the void and hoping they stick?
Yeah, you test for a lot of other stuff to rule it out. They want to make sure my heart was okay. They want to make sure my endocrine functions were okay. We tested a lot. They thought maybe I had multiple sclerosis or transverse myelitis. You know, we're talking MRIs of the brain and the spinal cord. But there is no one exact test that will say you definitively have this. It's like some other diseases out there where it's a diagnosis of exclusion, but it's meaning you have to just rule out a lot of other stuff. But it has a lot to do with just taking a careful history from the patient and saying, what are your symptoms?
Now, you went through a kind of a string of specialists, right?
I did. I saw two neurologists, two or three endocrinologists, two cardiologists.
Yeah, yeah.
It was tough. And people looked at me and said, you are super fit. You look healthy. You know, this doesn't match what we think of things like chronic fatigue syndrome.
Right, right. Now, at the time, you had just started as chief at Kaiser Permanente of their orthopedic department when you had to start looking at taking a leave of absence. How did your colleagues, friends, and family respond to you both pre and post diagnosis?
I hid it completely from everybody I worked with. So it was a, you know, sort of abrupt announcement to my colleagues, hey, I've been sick for 6 years and I'm leaving work for I don't know how long.
Yeah.
And I always say people with chronic fatigue are not healthy people pretending they're sick. It's sick people pretending they're healthy. And that was definitely the case for me. I was hiding it. I was trying to just get through every day without, you know, crashing and, you know, having to sleep on the floor. And so when I abruptly left, I got a lot of, you know, messages from my colleagues saying, you know, we don't know what's going on, but we wish you well. And I wound up leaving work for 10 months. And during that time, as you might imagine, rumors spread of, does he have cancer? Does he have neurologic disease? These other things. And so when I came back, I tried my best to initially avoid a straightforward answer. I still felt that there was a stigma around the words chronic fatigue syndrome. So I said I had dysautonomia, which is part of the nervous system disorder inside chronic fatigue syndrome. And eventually I just got to a point where I said, this is too difficult for me and too confusing for everybody else. I need to just lay it out there.
Yeah. Yeah. I still think that one of your partners probably thought to themselves, I bet it's a broken penis. I bet it is. I just got a feeling. I know of a couple of them. They're squirrely human beings.
Lance threw that out there.
I know, right? That's 100% who I was thinking that would be. Your mentor and closest partner at Kaiser was somebody that we both know, Dr. Jeff Rutke.
The man.
The man, the myth, the legend.
The Colonel.
The fucking Colonel, man. And I feel like you got to throw that effing in there because he would appreciate it. Did you know that Rucky squares like a sailor getting audited by the IRS while trying to deal with post-shore leave VD? Were you aware of that? Did you know about that?
I learned it early in my tenure when we would do difficult cases together. But you have to listen closely. He's almost a polite swear.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Yeah,
it's whispered.
Yeah, it's the whispered threat that moment where you're like, okay, so normally this guy talks very slow, very methodically, very deliberately, and then out come the swear words, and you're like, I should keep an eye on this one.
Every time he came into my office for the first 10 years, not 1 year, 10. I thought I was in trouble because he would stand there wait before he said what he was going to say. And oh, God, I'm getting fired. This is it. It's over.
But of course, you know, not only is he a, you know, fantastic person and a wonderful surgeon, he's also a really great dancer, too. I don't know if you knew that.
That I haven't seen.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He beats me at pool and does a little jig, little Irish Rucky jig.
I talk about him a little bit in the book because I refer to us as slightly an odd couple. He's a career military man, and I'm not.
Yeah, yeah, you are very not, and that comes across.
And he read the book and it was gracious as always. And his first comment to me was, "You were a wild child."
That you were. That's freaking hysterical. So, physician, endurance athlete, how much of your sense of self was wrapped up in identifying with those two very, very time, energy, and emotion investment pursuits and profession?
Yeah. A lot, more than I recognized at the time. I loved running, but I also loved, you know, being a runner, being a triathlete. And it was, you know, running is a great endeavor for people who are bad at planning fun. So, because you know what your fun's going to be every day. You're going for a run. It doesn't take a lot of creativity. And I loved it. I loved being in the mountains. I also loved the accomplishment of being a surgeon as much as I liked being a surgeon, mostly because in high school I was voted most likely to sleep in class. I'm not kidding. I was not headed for anything academic when I left high school. And so it was, sort of figuring out who I was in college and then eventually medical school. And, you know, I got to a point where I was just very proud of making a career out of medicine. And so, yeah, both those things were huge to me, and they both ended the work thing ended very abruptly. The exercise, you know, being a triathlete and a runner, sort of was tapering and then fizzling out.
Interesting. And don't worry about the whole voted most likely to fall asleep in class. I think to this day am voted most likely to fall asleep during a surgery. So I don't think that's not something you have to worry about. I'm in high school. Psh, who even pays attention to that? But if my head goes nod down while I'm doing a, you know, an AP resection or something, yeah, that I get yelled at. In the latter pages of the book, and this is something that I really identified with, you mentioned hating the feeling of being vulnerable and weak. And in the book, you have this unbelievable chapter where your brother comes out to see you and you're at literally the lowest point of your disease process. Can you describe that period in time? And then where do you think your hatred of being vulnerable and weak, you know, stems from? Because I think vulnerability and weakness are very, very different things. I think that it takes strength to be vulnerable.
Yeah, that's something that I think I learned through this whole process. So I was, again, struggling and hiding it at work. And when I left, I was so sick that I went home and stayed in bed for close to 2 or 3 months. And I was sick anytime I wasn't lying down in bed. So sitting up in a chair was difficult. And my brother came out to see me. I have a twin brother, and he's a runner also. And when he came to see me, you know, I think it was sort of shocking for him to see me in this condition. And at that point, I had abandoned any vanity around this. I just was, you know, a mess, an absolute mess, physically, yeah, mentally, and emotionally. And at that point, you have to ask for help. You just have to. And I had been reluctant to do that. You know, I was in a role of helping others. I was in a role of leading others. And, you know, I think part of it was not wanting to, I wanted to lead by example and not not feel like I had to drain or draw from others. I think that's probably, you know, a childhood thing. Mm-hmm. You know, somewhere along the way with a tough dad, or growing up in the 70s and 80s, you know, the sort of boy roles. And I think all those things combined turned me into somebody who just didn't like to put themselves out there as being weak, as needing help. And it was something that got me far, but it was also a character flaw in some way. And writing the book was a total break from that.
I have this kind of theory that we oftentimes will project what we stigmatize out into the wider world. And sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong. But on this, I think that chronic fatigue syndrome, which is something that I have a beloved family member suffering from and has for a couple of decades. And even for me, somebody that, you know, works in a clinical setting, even I was not immune to seeing everything like this, you know, chronic fatigue syndrome, addiction, alcoholism, all of these things through this very, very biased lens. And I worry very much that all of those sort of formative things that you were talking about with the, you know, the gender roles and growing up in the, you know, just rub some dirt on it kind of mentality. Right. We look at these patients that come through our lives, or these people that come through our lives with these terrible conditions, and we just add on to, you know, the greater social stigma that they're unfortunately affected by.
Yeah, you bring up an excellent point. There probably is part of us that looks at somebody who's struggling and you think, I don't want to be like that, or I'm afraid of being like that, and judge them harshly the way that you might judge yourself if you were in that position. And I think further, it is a lot of ignorance from, you know, the truest sense. You don't understand it. You don't understand alcoholism, or you don't understand something like chronic fatigue fully if you haven't been through it, if somebody really close to you hasn't been through it. And you make some assumptions.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
This person is misbehaving. This person is weak or lazy. This person, you know, is not mentally strong. And or somebody somewhere along the way, a dad, a mom, a teacher, taught you the wrong way.
Yeah.
Alcoholics are bad people. You know, unfortunately, you know, it's some of, you know, there's hate in the world that comes from, you know, family and folk that are teaching it to the ones below them.
Yeah. 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 How worried were you that the book would be well received?
It did weigh on me when I was finishing the book. Is this something I'm proud of? Is this something that will sell 5 copies and and never be heard of.
Sell five copies to your wife who doesn't tell you that she bought five copies.
Exactly. The as we are probably prone to do now, I joined groups on social media, so some author groups, and there are people out there. My book sold three copies this month. Oh my gosh. And so some of that rubbed off on me. Is this going to happen to my book? And more than anything, at the end of it, I just looked at what I had written. I reread it several times, went through literally sentence by sentence, and said, is this meeting my standards? And then eventually, can I accept, this is the best book that I can write in this way, and I eventually got to a point where I said, I'm proud of this book. It reads better than I thought it ever would have. Done is better than perfect. There's probably 10 years I could continue to tweak it here and there, but I'm not willing to do that, and I might even ruin it if I do that. And so I launched it out into the world, being very happy with the finished product. And then checking how many book sales I had every single day.
Yeah, like constantly worrying about it. Right. I totally understand that, man.
Right.
I'm always kind of number hounding whenever I've got a Twitch stream or, checking the podcast numbers. Just like every single person that clicks a subscribe or clicks a download is just another little tiny dopamine hit.
When I reach enlightenment, I will no longer need that feedback, but I'm not there yet.
But why can't enlightenment be found in like a box of my kid's Cinnamon Toast Crunch? Why do I have to like disappear to Tibet for like 16 to 35 right. to 50 years to be able to
right.
get that? Like,
yeah,
that seems like that seems bullshitty to me. a little bit, maybe.
Isn't there a faster way to enlightenment?
What the heck? Isn't there a fast track? I can get a fast track at the DMV now. I can't get it to enlightenment. This seems just society's priorities are off. That's all I'm saying. So, but this book is in reference to the previous question, this book is you being about as vulnerable as I think a person that I've ever seen, read, or heard that wasn't going through recovery, wasn't an addict of some kind.
Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate it. It was something that I had to ask myself a lot. Am I willing to put this in the book? Am I willing to put that in there? And the book sort of just poured out of me. I wrote the rough draft in 6 weeks and 100,000 words, and it was cathartic for me. And I feel like I was struggling with a lot of big issues, not just the illness. It was, is my career over? Am I ever going to exercise again? If that doesn't happen, what does it mean? And, life went on top of it. I actually was the sickest during the pandemic and no doctor would see me. So it was just a lot going on.
Yeah. I can't even imagine how incredibly frustrating that must have been. Like feeling that absolutely terrible. And folks, you got to read this book. Feeling that incredibly terrible and then not being able to see anybody. And then when you do finally start seeing people, getting what I imagine was, feeling like you were getting nowhere.
Yeah. There was two separate nights where I felt like, well, I guess I felt so sick. The question was, will I see the sunrise again? And I would not go to the emergency room for fear of COVID, because remember, we didn't know what the hell this thing was in March and April of 2020.
Yep.
And people were dying at really high rates.
Ridiculously high rates, yeah.
Full. And so it was a really scary couple of months for me. And I thought a lot of the people out there who just found a lump and are told, we'll see in 6 months, is this a tumor? Is it, what is this?
Yep.
So there's probably a lot of people out there who really went through and are still probably seeing the after effects of that. Cause if they didn't get treated on time, it was a moment in our lifetimes that hopefully we don't see again.
I mean, I'm not a religious man, but God help.
Yeah.
God hoping. Did you ever struggle with suicidal ideation?
This journey for me has included a ton of ups and downs, including repeatedly thinking, I'm cured, it's over, I'm back to normal. And then thinking, oh my God, I'm dying, what's happening? I don't know what's happening. And at that really, really low point during COVID, when no one would see me and I felt sick just 24 hours a day, I got to a breaking point where I didn't know if I could deal with the suffering anymore. I felt so sick every waking moment of the day. And I started to think and plan. This is, you know, if this doesn't go away, doesn't get better, I can't live like this. And, yeah. You know, I spoke to my wife briefly about it, and she said, give me 5 years, you hang in there. And I thought,
oh my God,
I can't take it 5 more days. And she said, we're gonna get through this, you can, you know, you're gonna get better, we just need time. And you know, she was right, but I think it was more than anything like luck, expand your horizon. And for me it was, what is happening this moment? I feel so ungodly sick. What can I do? And,
yeah.
You know, I'm not a sophisticated man. My barometer was, if I take a shower, it'll make me feel better.
And my grundle will be clean.
And I would take a shower and my heart rate would be 150 beats a minute in the shower. And I would feel awful, absolutely awful, and have to lie down for a couple hours. And you know, just that simple fact that, like, geez, even a shower makes me feel worse, was like, nothing is helping. And there was no medicine to take and no doctor to see. And it was a struggle of the, you know, the highest order. But I have kids, I have family, you know, you think about all those other things, and it's the pros and cons.
I, you know, the kids thing, that hits home. The last night that I drank, December 15th of 2019, my wife was at work. My wife, who you know, my wife was at work, and I had been struggling for years now, and the amount of gaslighting, lying, how I felt physically, how I felt emotionally, and the emotional toll that I knew was being taken on specifically my wife. My kids were young enough not to, I think, really have to deal with it just yet. But yeah, there was a moment when there was a small paring knife right on the kitchen counter, and for about a minute I really did think about it. And the only thing that really kept my hand at bay was knowing that it would have been my oldest that would have found me, and I couldn't imagine doing that to him. I'd had a mentor figure when I was in my middle 20s that killed himself because of substance abuse, who I don't remember if it was his kids that found him. I don't remember that. But regardless of whether it was or wasn't, it was enough for me to say, you know what, I have to stop. I've got to figure out something, and I've got to get past this. I got to figure out a way to move myself into somewhere healthy. I don't see how, but I got to figure it out. So
yeah, it is wild and scary. You know, I had the same ideas, you know, with my children, and I have lost friends who specifically gave up because of addiction. And it's crazy. You know, it's something the first time that happened, I thought, why didn't he just stop?
Yeah.
You know, and obviously we're not thinking clearly when we're doing that, or the physical toll is so severe. And thank God you're still here. Thank God I'm still here.
Yeah, yeah. I'm real glad that you're still here. And to be honest, I'm real glad I'm here. The last 2 years since getting sober have been the best years of my life. And I don't know if that's something that you can say about the last 2 years of your life, but I have nothing but hope for the future. So how do you see yourself now? You know, we have this massive change where you are basically having to reinvent how you look and feel about yourself. How do you see yourself now?
complicated question.
Yeah, no, that's a big one.
You know, part of it, the physical being of me, I look in the mirror and go, oh, gross, I'm jiggly. you know, because I'm 49 now, I'm getting close to 50 this summer. So there is sort of the, you know, age takes a little bit of toll on everyone, but I was in sort of this peak physical condition that's gone. I have to accept that. I don't identify as, you know, a runner and a triathlete anymore. And I'm trying to not identify really as, you know, a surgeon anymore. I want to really think of myself as just a human being, a dad, a husband, and try to do things that and see myself in ways that are, I think, are healthy for me and healthy for people around me. Did I help someone today?
Yeah.
Was
yeah.
I a good friend? Was I a good son? You know, those sorts of things, which I think we all think about. But now for me, that's more of my identity, I suppose.
I think that totally 100% tracks. I think that the impetus for you to become a physician comes not only from, you know, wanting to stretch your intellect, also, you know, there's a million reasons to want to be a physician. But once you're there and once you dedicate your life to it, and you really show this in the book how much you care about the people that you care for, you want to care for people. And while your focus might not be in the operating room, I still feel like you're going to find ways to try to help people. And I think that this book is a really, really great, you know, sort of first step into, and this is a big first step, by the way, first step into finding other avenues to make sure that not only are you fulfilled in helping people, but that people get help when they need it.
Yeah, it's been cool so far because I've had emails and, you know, I was on a phone call with an American living in Belgium who doesn't know what's going on with their health, and she read the book and just wanted to reach out to me, and you know, a friend of a friend, and it has been great for me to try to help and connect with people on a one-to-one basis and put a book out there that people can read and understand the, you know, the whole illness and life that goes along with it better. And, you know, for me now, it's, you know, I know a lot of things from the big book and Bill W. because I have a lot of friends and family that are in recovery. And, you know, as is said, if you want self-esteem, you have to do esteemable things. And so for me, you know, I'm trying to do esteemable things as part of rebuilding my identity.
Right, right. Speaking of addiction, you mentioned in the book having two siblings and a close friend that all suffered from addiction. These are the ones that I drew from memory and then went back to make sure. But one regrettably has passed as a direct result of their alcoholism. And then your brother and sister, they're currently in recovery, correct?
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
So my friend in the book who passed, like me, actually, he had a very complicated situation. The isolation of COVID plus a divorce and recent joblessness added to his alcoholism in a way that was unfathomable. He had never been hospitalized, even for a, you know, got drunk and bumped, you know, fell down or, you know, whatever, no DUIs, no, you know, all these, you know, I see lots and lots of patients during hospitalizations that are alcohol related because people break things, and I'm an orthopedic surgeon. And it was shocking to me to get a call from his mom saying the words liver failure, kidney failure, sepsis. I go, whoa, 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 what? And having dealt with my brother and my sister who have both struggled with drugs and alcohol, you know, it has been a common theme in my life. And I do make a comparison in the book to what addiction does to individuals and what it does to families, to how chronic fatigue affects individuals and families. Mm-hmm. And it's things like job loss, divorce, destitution, physical demise. You know, there are a lot of parallels. They're obviously not the same illness.
No, obviously not.
But it's been a constant theme in my life. And so I talk a lot about it. And I think people who have friends and families or personal stories that revolve around addiction, I think will understand the parallels that I'm drawing.
Yeah, and like, so those parallels, like originally I thought that the link between ME/CFS and addiction were kind of tenuous, but you know, after reading through the entire book and then speaking with you previously, the trying to call into attention one thing that I think that is, I think that alcoholism and addiction are a little less misunderstood than CFS.
Yeah,
having that to bridge, I think that that was actually a pretty good reason to bring that as an aspect of your of the story that you were trying to tell.
I just feel like people, I almost don't know anybody who doesn't have someone in their life that has struggled with it. And so people can wrap their head around it. It is still hard for people to wrap their head around. What do you mean you can't shovel the driveway because it makes you sick? Didn't I just see you carrying the groceries in? It's like, yeah, I don't know. It's difficult. But if you talk more about what it does to people, you know, I think people can understand that better. And certainly addiction, people see, I know what that does to people. People lose their jobs. People, you know, get divorced, that sort of thing.
Yeah. And you dabbled with, you know, alcohol and some lighter substances, including a very, very amusing story that basically goes, hello, I'm Michael. I'm on shrooms. Can you take me to the hospital? Because there, you know, and I think that you believe this as well, that there's a genetic predisposition towards addiction that's possible. What is it that you think allowed you to be able to step away from substances when, you know, your twin brother and your sister were unable to do so until things had become kind of dire for both of them?
I think for me, it was this other intense focus. So my addiction really was exercise. I was running 80 miles a week. I was doing, you know, triathlon, and I was also very busy with medical school and then residency and work. And I think there was, when I woke up in the morning, it was, can I do my run? And I need to do my run to clear my head to do my job. And God forbid I showed up and was too hungover to help somebody, or worse, hurt somebody because, mm-hmm. you know, I'm not paying attention to what I'm doing in the operating room. And I think those intense focuses kept me away from that. I think part of it is luck. I think, you know, my twin brother and I still see the world very, very similarly, but mm-hmm. there's certain things that he experienced as a kid that I didn't. Maybe he saw an episode of Gilligan's Island that I didn't. And
he looked at it and went, you know what that coconut radio needs? Rum.
Exactly. I'm sure there was an episode at some point where somebody accidentally fermented a coconut and got drunk.
Yeah, he kind of hope so on that island. Whoosh, whoosh.
But yeah, you know, and the fact of the matter is, people become alcoholics in their 60s and 70s that weren't before. My sister was a goody two-shoes who never drank or smoked or anything until she was like 40.
Yeah.
And so you can't let your guard down. I can't let my guard down. There's a ton of it in my family. And, you know, I don't run anymore. So, you know, I have to be careful and say, look, channel my energy to writing books and being on Will's podcast.
Every week if you want, buddy.
I smell co-host status.
I'm kicking out the other two. Fuck you guys. Shit, I lost my train of thought. That was a really good joke. Good job, Mike. You stumped the host. You should get a dollar. Yeah. So one of the things that we talk about in recovery is sublimating your addiction for another addiction. And if you have, you know, if you had running, yeah, alcohol's got to be something that you've got to be on the lookout for, because your normal coping mechanism is unfortunately probably in your past, unless, you know, by some miracle, a curative comes up. For me, I worry about video game addiction or addiction to, like, I love to play poker. I think of the game more in terms of the learning the strategy and learning how to play the game for the game's sake. But there's an aspect of gambling to it that you know, does make me worry. I'm there with you.
I mean, I will tell you, Will, like, I never bet on sports in my life until the past couple of years. And I wasn't on Instagram until like a year ago. You know, there are things that I have to be careful about because, my coping mechanism was running and I don't have that anymore. And it was so important to me. So yeah, I'll have to constantly look for new ways to channel my energy and deal with the ups and downs of life, because life continues to go on during recovery from, you know, whatever it is, or during the worst of whatever it is you're dealing with.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. So, you know, these are stigmatized conditions that are seen professionally and culturally through a pretty negative and biased lens. What would you like to see changed in medicine and culturally as we are, you know, trying to bring a certain amount of compassion and enlightenment to people that really do need it?
I think the biggest thing is believing patients. As I said before, I think people with chronic fatigue are sick people trying to pretend they're healthy. And by and large, that's true. There are a few people here and there that, because of, you know, some financial reward or, you know, motive to get away from some other obligation, may go to the doctor and say, oh, I'm sick and there's no test for chronic fatigue. And so there's a skepticism that goes along with that. But I think by and large, if you really listen to patients' stories, I think it's pretty straightforward to figure out who is really struggling with something legitimate here and who is not. And if you just listen and believe people, I think you're going to find out the answer. And then, you know, the stigma that exists for ME/CFS is this person is lazy or they are trying to avoid work. That's just not the case. People want to live normal lives. And I think giving them the benefit of the doubt is what we really need.
And, like, what's the worst thing that comes from giving somebody the benefit of the doubt? Like, what's the worst possible outcome from that? Somebody gets one over on you? Like, I want to live in a world where
I think that's what...
No, go ahead, please.
No, I was just, I'm probably going to echo your sentiment, which is, you know, are you that fearful of someone pulling the wool over your eyes?
Right. Like, I would much rather live in an uncynical world where I help 4 out of 10 people that really need it than worry about the 6 people that might not or are trying to get one over on me. I think that an uncynical world is where we need to move towards. I think that there are people that genuinely need help. And it's more important to help those people than to worry about whether or not somebody's gaming the system.
Absolutely. And if you really look at it, the benefits that people are getting that are gaming the system are so minuscule. I mean, they're not sitting on $100,000 a year income because claim to be sick or something like that. I mean, we are not talking about a lavish lifestyle here.
No, not at all. Not at all. So, how can people get involved with ME/CFS awareness if they choose to?
There's an organization that I think does great work called ME-Action, meaction.org, and they have tons of information. If you know anybody who thinks they might have it or somebody who has it and you want to learn more, Emmy Action is great, and they have a campaign called #MillionsMissing. Millions Missing refers to the millions of people who are missing out on their normal life because of this illness. I just think they do great work. So if you can donate to them, or if you just want to use them for their resources, I think that really is a great place to start.
So last couple of questions, we'll do two funny ones and then one that ends on a happy note. There's an interesting passage at the beginning of your book, and I want to ask you, when will the kids be old enough to read Daddy's Naughty Little Book?
My daughter picked it up and started to read a little bit of it, and I asked her to not do that. I'm thinking somewhere close to 30 might be an appropriate age.
Realistically
18 might be a good starting point.
Was there something about Germany and a strip club?
It was actually a brothel. I'll leave it to your listeners to consider whether or not that's enough of a tease to go listen to or buy the book.
It's a great story. The one thing that I like the most about it is the idea of bath towels, peanuts, and no hand sanitizer in sight. So you should definitely check out the book for all of that wonderful, wonderful stuff, including the answer to the next question, or at least the context for it. Do you think that Liam has a picture of Luke in the middle of a corkboard in a room lit with a single bulb, a spider's web worth of yarn, pins, and three little letter acronyms somewhere in a basement that he thinks is off-grid but is actually just a bathroom at a Burger King?
I was and am blessed with a cadre of friends in my life that are supreme characters. Not one of them is milquetoast and boring. They are all, very colorful characters, shall we say. And Liam, the most colorful of them all. And yes, he sends me text messages that have Jason Bourne plot lines and I talk a lot about those two in the book, simply because they're a large part of my life and always entertaining. I think I might have to write a follow-up just about those two.
That would probably be Wouldn't it suck if, like, the book that you wrote about the thing that you want people to be really, really interested in sells worse than the stories of Liam and Luke? God, that'd be funny.
My goofball friends.
Your goofball friends. My last question for you, Mike. Are you hopeful?
I am super hopeful right now for a couple of reasons. One, I'm so much better physically and emotionally than I was in 2020 at my low point. That is amazing. It's amazing to wake up every day and not feel sick and get out of bed and not have to check my heart rate when I get to the sink to make sure I don't need to, you know, sit right back down. So there's a ton of physical improvement that I've had, and that makes me really hopeful. The biggest thing is there are a lot of parallels between ME/CFS and COVID long haulers, the people who had COVID and still have symptoms months and sometimes years down the road. And that has actually led to a lot of research that's going on, both for long COVID and for ME/CFS. And I have my sort of ear to the ground on a lot of this stuff. And there's some really incredible research that's going on that I think potentially could help me and help a lot of us, you know, within the next 5 or 10 years. So who knows? Maybe I'll run a mile again someday in my life. But even if I don't, I think there's a lot of possibility out there.
That's great. Well, Mike, I can't thank you enough for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you. I love the book. I can't wait to. We already started doling out copies of it via the live stream. We're going to give a couple more copies out the evening that this podcast drops over on our Twitch channel. Dr. Michael Gallagher, thank you so much, man. Thank you so very, very much.
Well, you're the best. I loved it. It's been a great fun, and thanks for all your listeners.
Yeah, absolutely, man. Absolutely. Alcoholics Anonymous, AA.org, 212-870-3400. Moderation Management, moderation.org, 212-871-0974. Secular AA, SOSSobriety.org, 323-693-1633. Smart Recovery, smartrecovery.org, 440-951-5357. Women for Sobriety, womenforsobriety.org, 215-536-8026. And for friends and family that need a little help in a group type setting, there's Al Anon Family Groups at www.al-anon.alateen.org, or they can be reached at 1-888-425-2666. My guest tonight was Dr. Michael Gallagher. His book, Run Down, an Endurance Athlete's Race Against Chronic Fatigue Syndrome. It's been an absolute pleasure having him. It was a great chat, and we look forward to interacting with him maybe sometime down the road. From all of us here at the Save vs. Poison podcast, we wish you warm, creamy regards. Good night, everybody. You've just listened to another episode of the Save vs. Poison podcast. If you liked what you heard, please follow us, like, and subscribe on Twitter at @VS_save, on Facebook at the Save vs. Poison podcast, and streaming live on Twitch at twitch.tv/SVP podcast. Thanks so much for joining us, and stay safe, everyone.